This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.
And then the third S is strength. If you have a Bible, please turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. The third S is strength. Struggle, slavery, and strength. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 9 and 10. I am the least of the apostles, and I'm not worthy to be called an apostle because I persecuted the church of God. Nevertheless, by the grace of God, I am what I am, and His grace to me was not in vain. But I labored more abundantly than they all, yet not I, but the grace of God that was with me. There's a life-changing text. Paul might well have been engulfed in immobilizing guilt for his whole life. How would you feel if you had been defending the cause of God only to discover that you had been assaulting the Messiah of God, perhaps responsible for putting people to death? How would you feel if, like this lady now on death row in Texas, if you had brutally murdered a pair of people? I mean, could you ever recover from that? Paul says, by the grace of God, I am what I am, and His grace to me was not in vain. I labored more abundantly than they all. Grace energized him. He was not immobilized in guilt. In fact, there was energy released in him at his conversion that led to labor surpassing that of the other apostles. Even Peter, despite his recovery, didn't labor so abundantly as Paul. The greater the depth of sin, the greater the appreciation for grace. Grace energizes you in the face of paralyzing guilt. And the other verse is 2 Corinthians 12, verse 9. And he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I glory in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Some of you know that verse. If it gets out of your intellect into the depths of your being so that it determines the way you function, it can change your life. That's a real weakness. It's not strength masquerading as weakness. How often have you entered a pulpit and felt absolutely powerless, only to discover that the flooding of the soul by the Spirit of power surprised you, startled you by its potency? All right, then, let's turn to Paul's letter to the Galatians. As we do so, let me urge you to keep up with these reading assignments. For example, by next Tuesday, you should have read pages 6 through 30 in the syllabus, especially the latter part of that section on a history of Pauline studies. Very important for getting into the contemporary debate over Paul and the law, which lies at the heart of Galatians. Okay, your text is open to Galatians, I trust. Now would you look at page 43 in the syllabus. This is a literary analysis of Galatians. I deliberately refrain from the definite article. I can expect some of you are going to come to me and say, well, now just what you want in this literary analysis? The idea being to get at the analysis I have in my head so that yours can conform to it. That takes all the fun out of it. You would learn a lot more about Galatians if you did your own literary analysis than just looking at the one I did. But I've even thought about requiring 13 literary analyses and distributing all these lectures in written form, maybe next summer. But short of that, I offer you this as a literary analysis. Some of you begin to put up your defenses when you hear the word literary, because you're perhaps accustomed to approaches to Paul that put the literary in place of the theological. The point is, literary appreciation can deepen your awareness of the theology. So look at this structure. First, you have the salutation. Then you have an opening message, which is typical of Paul's letters. And then you have the body of the letter, 1:11 down to 6:10. A formal opening, introduction of the major theme, which is the euangelion, the gospel. First main section, 1:13 to 2:14, the messenger. Second main section, 2:15 to 5:12, the message. Third main section, 5:13 to 6:10, the ethical implication. Then the closing of the letter. Now look up here. By the color coding, you can see links between one part of the letter and another. Fascinating connections between the salutation and the closing, not just of Galatians, but of any number of Pauline epistles. And then the opening message, the horror over the false gospel, paves the way for the introducing of the major theme, which is Paul's own gospel. And then because his apostleship is in question, the first major section is devoted to a defense of his apostleship, 1:13 to 2:14. That prepares the way for the message. What's his gospel? 2:15 to 5:12. The major proposition of the letter, Galatians 2:15 to 21. There's a passage to memorize, not only in English, but if you so aspire, in Greek. To get at the heart of Galatians, pay special attention to 2:15 to 21. And then the lengthy argument from the Old Testament, 3:1 to 4:31. And then 5:1 to 12, you will discover, harks back to the opening message. I have both circled in blue. 5:1 to 12 will take you back to 1:6 to 10. And then here are the ethical implications. If you were doing an analysis of Galatians, you would find that 1:6 to 10 down to 5:12 are dominated by the declarative. And 5:13 to 6:10 are dominated by the hortatory, or the imperative, ethical implications. Then the closing message. Then the closing of the letter. Please turn now to Galatians chapter 1 and to page 44. In your syllabus. First of all, the setting of Galatians. And here I refer you to those pages in the introduction. First, the recipients. I want to give you two main points under one. Point number one, I entitled The Churches of Galatia. That's the way it looks in the Greek text. Verse 2. And those, all the brothers with me, to the churches, ecclesiais, of Galatia. Glance down from Galatians 1, verse 2, to verse 13, where he talks about persecuting the church of God. Ekklesia tou Theou. Churches, Galatians 1, verse 2, the church, Galatians 1, verse 13. I'm going to be referring to the original languages. If you have had no Greek or Hebrew, fear not. I hope this will induce you to take Hebrew and or Greek. But in the past, some of the best students in this course have had no Hebrew and Greek. That's not to say, back out of your Hebrew exegesis class. Don't take Greek exegesis. That's the term in Greek, ekklesia tou Theou, transliterated that way. That's the language of Galatians 1:13. Now, Paul's language is rooted in the Old Testament. Paul's mind is saturated with Old Testament Hebrew theology. And the corresponding terms in the Old Testament are Kahal Yahweh and Kahal Israel. You can find that expression in Deuteronomy 23, verse 2, the assembly of Yahweh. Kahal Israel, Deuteronomy 31, verse 30. When Paul speaks about the church of God, he's using language in continuity with language used in the Hebrew Bible for the covenant community. As a matter of fact, this Greek word ekklesia occurs around 100 times in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, to translate kahal. Does everyone understand just what I said, what I just said? The Septuagint, LXX, is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. And this word ekklesia occurs about 100 times in the Septuagint to render this Hebrew term. Now, here's the interesting thing. Go down to verse 13 again. You know my manner of life in Judaism. How, to an extreme degree, I persecuted the church of God. He doesn't say, you know my manner of life in Israel. No, in Judaism. And as an advocate of Judaism, he persecutes the church of God. Judaism, as represented by Paul, opposes the church of God. The church of God is not in continuity with Judaism, but with what? Old Testament Israel. Look at Galatians chapter 6, verse 16. Galatians 6 and verse 16. Peace be upon them, and mercy also upon the Israel of God. The church is the Israel of God. Gentiles in Christ are united to the seed of Abraham. Already in verse 13, you get that contrast. The churches of Galatia, these churches and others together, the church of God, are in continuity with Old Testament Israel. They are the true heirs of Abraham. That's point number one under recipients. Point number two, the South Galatian churches. there I simply take a position. When you read the introduction and other sources, you will discover that there's a debate over just who these recipients are. Is this provincial Galatia, or is it ethnic Galatia? I'm simply taking a position that the churches of Galatia are the churches founded on Paul's first missionary journey, as recorded in Acts chapters 13 and 14. Namely, Antioch in Pisidia, Iconium, Lystra, and Derbe. So I'm a South Galatianist. That's not just because I'm a Mississippian. I think the evidence favors it. You can read some very learned commentaries that take the North Galatian view. So I believe the recipients are in provincial Galatia, not ethnic Galatia. To be continued when you read the introduction. So the church is founded on Paul's first missionary journey, Acts 13 and 14. Antioch in Pisidia, Iconium, Lystra, and Derbe. We come then to point B, the date. Please turn back in your syllabus to page 5. The Lord's syllabus. On page 5, you'll find a chronology of the life of Paul. Again, a chronology, not the chronology. A lot of these dates are debated. According to this chronology, the first missionary journey occurred in 46 to 47 A.D. The Apostolic Council, 48 or 49, and you'll notice that Galatians is placed between those two lines. Okay, let me give you 4 points under B concerning the date. Point number one, Paul and Barnabas are in South Galatia around 47 to 48 A.D. And the Jerusalem Council met in Jerusalem in 49 A.D. And Paul wrote Galatians shortly before the council, so in late 48 or early 49 A.D. Paul and Barnabas in South Galatia, 47 to 48, Council of Jerusalem, 49. Galatians written shortly before the council in late 48 or early 49. Point number two, Galatians is written from Antioch in Syria during the period described at the close of Acts 14. Galatians is written from Antioch in Syria, not to be confused with Antioch in Pisidia, during the period described at the close of Acts 14. Please turn to that chapter, Acts 14, verses 26 to 28. This is the close of the first missionary journey. Acts 14, 26, from Attalia they sailed back to Antioch, where they had been committed to the grace of God for the work they had now completed. On arriving there, they gathered the church together and reported all that God had done through them and how he had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles. And they stayed there a long time with the disciples. It's during that long time, I suggest, that Galatians was written from Antioch in Syria. Keep your text open to that point. Point number three. On this view, Galatians is like an overture to the General Assembly, addressing the very issue that the council faced. Look at Acts 15 and verse 1. Some men came down from Judea to Antioch and were teaching the brothers, "Unless you are circumcised according to the custom taught by Moses, you cannot be saved." Isn't that the issue in Galatians? That very issue. So Galatians is written close to the beginning of the apostolic council, addressing this very issue. One argument favoring Galatians before the council is this. If Galatians were written after the council, would not it bolster Paul's argument to refer to the apostolic decree? That, to me, is a strong argument in favor of Galatians already having been written before the council convenes. Does everyone understand that point? If you read Acts 15, you've got the whole weight of the Jerusalem leadership behind this decree, James and Peter. Why doesn't Paul invoke this decree if Galatians is written after its issue? That leads to point number four, just to get our chronological bearings. You will recognize that if you were to go in and do doctoral studies in Galatians, everything I've said is debatable. Everything. What would people have to write doctoral dissertations on if everybody agreed on these things? This is the way I look at it. Dick Longnecker's commentary on Galatians takes the same view. Acts chapter 9 records Paul's conversion. The visit of Galatians 1 matches that of Acts 9, and I would place that around 35 A.D. That's only 3 to 5 years after the crucifixion of Christ. Now notice, in anticipation of coming developments, Acts chapter 10 records Peter's visit to the house of Cornelius. And then at the end of Acts chapter 11, you have another visit. Pause long enough to turn to that passage. Look at Acts chapter 11. Verse 27. Keep your place at Acts 11 and also a place at Galatians chapter 2. During this time, some prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. One of them, named Agabus, stood up and through the Spirit predicted that a severe famine would spread over the entire Roman world. This happened during the reign of Claudius. The disciples, each according to his ability, decided to provide help for the brothers living in Judea. This they did, sending their gift to the elders by Barnabas and Saul. Now, with that paragraph in mind, turn to Galatians chapter 2, verse 1. 14 years later, I went up again to Jerusalem, this time with Barnabas. There it is, Paul and Barnabas. Verse 2, I went in response to a revelation. Was this revelation Agabus' prophecy? Maybe, maybe not. End of verse 2, I did this privately to those who seemed to be leaders. Remember the reference to the elders in Jerusalem. Verse 10, all they asked was that we should continue to remember the poor, the very thing I was eager to do, as demonstrated by this visit, the famine relief visit. So I'm suggesting that the visit of Galatians 2 is the visit of Acts 11:27 to 30. And then, those verses that we read at the close of Acts 14, it's during that long period that you have the encounter between Paul and Peter at Antioch, as recorded in Galatians 2, 11 to 14. Isn't that encounter one of the spurs to the writing of Galatians? So that, at any rate, is a satisfactory chronology in my judgment. But these are all matters that you'll need to continue thinking about. Let's come to point C, the opposition. Let me suggest, by the way, that when questions arise, if it's something that needs immediate attention, that you feel free to raise your hand. If it's a deeper issue, let me ask, in part because the course is being recorded, that you write out your question, and I promise you to address it in a later period. Okay, point C, the opposition. Galatians is written with great passion in the face of a serious threat to the Galatian believers. And that emergency is signaled already in verses 6 and 7. Of the opening chapter. Have a look at that. Galatians 1, verse 6, I am astonished that you're so quickly deserting the one who called you by the grace of Christ and turning to a different gospel. And then the words to follow, where the intensity increases. Let me try to give you a profile of the opposition together with their argument. First, their identity. Paul's opponents are conservative Jewish Christians from the Jerusalem church who come to Galatia as they came to the church in Antioch. Remember Acts 15, verse 1, they come down from Jerusalem to Antioch. And the same kind of person has descended upon the churches of South Galatia. They're champions of the law of Moses and of Jewish tradition. Let's not get sidetracked at the moment as to whether these are genuine Christians with a false message or people who are only nominal Christians and not genuinely so. At the moment, let's just be content to call them conservative Jewish Christians from the Mother Church of Jerusalem. Now, their position, negatively stated, and here you may not have enough room to get everything in which case, write it on the opposite page. Their position, negatively stated, consists of two main points. The first is Paul's dependence on Jerusalem. Point two, their position negatively stated. Point A, Paul's dependence on the Jerusalem apostles. You know, the more you can get inside the mentality of the Judaizers, the more you'll appreciate Galatians. 3 points under A. The Jerusalem leaders are the only persons authorized to say what the true gospel is. The Jerusalem apostles, the pillars, are the only persons with the authority to say what the true gospel is. That's obvious, is it not? Peter and John were among the original 12. They were with Jesus during the ministry. Paul probably never even saw Jesus, much less sat at his feet. If you want to know what the true gospel is, you've got to go to Jerusalem and listen to Peter and John and James. Point 2 under A. Any authority Paul exercises must be derived from the Jerusalem pillars. They're not questioning that he might legitimately gain their authority. But if he is to exercise true apostolic authority, this must come from the Jerusalem pillars. Otherwise, there's not the needed control over what he propagates. And point three, to support that point, the Judaizers would surely point to the fact that Paul had, in fact, visited Jerusalem. Not once, but twice before the writing of this letter. Why did he go to Jerusalem? If he doesn't go there to get apostolic authority, why does he go? He doesn't know anything about Jesus. He must needs consult Peter and the other apostles to learn what happened during the public ministry. He's been over there in Tarsus. He was up in Damascus. What does he know about the gospel if he hasn't gone to Jerusalem? Okay, point B. First, Paul's dependence. Secondly, Paul's departure from the Jerusalem apostles. First, his dependence on the Jerusalem apostles. Secondly, his departure from the Jerusalem gospel. 3 points under B. This is the opponent's case against Paul continued. He went to Jerusalem, but once he left Jerusalem, he began to alter his message to make it more acceptable to Gentiles. Paul had a fragile ego, and so in order to bolster it, he needed to find acceptance and success within his audience. As he is teaching Gentiles, he must needs water down this Jerusalem gospel to make it acceptable and palatable. That leads to the second point. Whereas the Jerusalem apostles championed the law of Moses, here is Paul advocating a law-free gospel within a pagan context. If anybody needs the gospel, it's these pagan Gentiles. What sort of licentiousness will multiply in the Pauline churches without the safeguard of the law of Moses? Don't underestimate the power of this argument. It's appealing to some of you, is it not? What dangerous counsel to say to Gentiles mired in fornication, you're free of the law of Moses. Did they never hear of the seventh commandment? And that leads to the third point under B. Paul is a hypocrite. There's an inconsistency between his own practice and his preaching. He preaches circumcision. Among Jewish Christians, he advocates circumcision. But he insists that Gentiles not be circumcised. When he's there in Jerusalem, some might say, he refuses to let Titus be circumcised. But what happens over in Acts 16 where he has Timothy circumcised? Is Paul being inconsistent? This is one of the ways in which he appeals to the Gentile audience. What adult Gentile male wants to be circumcised? You need not go through that pain. You're free of circumcision. Okay, let's go to the third point. I'm assuming those points are clear. Point number three. Their position positively stated. Again, there are 2 points. Point A, their declaration. Point A, their declaration. 3 points under A. We bring to you a sacred gospel, and we invite you into a noble tradition that goes all the way back to Abraham. Did not God promise that in Abraham all the Gentiles would be blessed? That's our tradition. Point B, or point two. In order that you may enter into the covenantal blessings, we bring you the holy, sacred, authoritative law of Moses. In order that you may experience the blessings of Abraham, we bring you the Sinaitic covenant, the law of Moses, given on the mountain. Did not Jesus say, I came not to destroy, but to fulfill the law? Point three. Now that Messiah has come, the new Moses, law keeping is even more important than before. How are you going to receive Messiah's blessing without subscription to the law of Moses? You cannot drive a wedge between the blessings of Messiah and the giving of the law on Sinai. That's their threefold declaration. Point B, their demand. This is B under three. With the declaration, there is a demand. And that can be stated in two ways. Point one, you must believe in Messiah Jesus, as we have done. But as proof of the seriousness of your commitment, you must submit to the stipulations of the law of Moses. Otherwise, how can we be sure about the depth and genuineness of that commitment? To enter fully into the covenantal blessings, you must submit to circumcision and other stipulations of the Mosaic Law. And the second point is just to show you reflections of this in Galatians. Read through Galatians in the light of this and notice how often Paul refers to circumcision. And notice how often he refers to works of the law. There are 30, no less than 30 references to the law of Moses in Galatians. Look at chapter 4 and verse 10 as well. Chapter 4, verse 10. You are observing special days and months and seasons and years. There's a thoroughly Hebraic statement. What's an example of a special day in Judaism? Day of Atonement. Sabbath. Months, seasons, years. Give me an example of a sacred year in Judaism. A year of Jubilee. So, chapter 4, verse 10 sort of puts the observations succinctly together. The Judaizers' demand, to put it just as concisely, is stated in Acts 15 and verse 1. I repeat. Acts 15 and verse 1. Some men came down from Judea to Antioch and were teaching the brothers, unless you're circumcised according to the custom taught by Moses, you cannot be saved. Now, at the bottom of the page, the central issue. The crucial question lying behind Galatians is this: upon what ground is one justified before God? Upon what ground is one justified before God? How I wish we had never read this letter before. With part of my being, I wish that. This debate and this issue has become bland because we're overexposed to it. Upon what ground is one justified before God? Brothers and sisters, at every turn, we face the issue. Is salvation based exclusively upon the achievement of Christ or upon His work together with mine? If you're not aware of the seriousness of this issue in the contemporary American church, I don't know where you have been. Now, Reformed Protestants, with our accent upon the doctrines of grace, including sola gratia, grace alone, quickly point to this era in other traditions, whether the Unification Church of Sun Myung Moon, or the Mormons, or the Church of Christ, or the Roman Catholic Church. When I was teaching at Bellhaven in an exegesis course of Galatians, I had a Church of Christ minister who tried to argue from Galatians 2:16 of all places that justification is Christ's achievement together with mine.
This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.